people might think that my Munster hat is too Munster. Got to get into a position where we're rewarding form as opposed to credit in the bank.
The Red 78 with Alan Quinlan and Niamh Briggs. Subscribe to the Rugby Channel on the OTB Sports app and turn on your notifications now.
OTB AM
with Gillette, proud supporters of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow.
All right, it's 7:30 on this Wednesday morning. You're welcome along to OTB AM. Owen Gerr and Kenny Cunningham with you right the way through until 10 o'clock this morning. Keith Wood coming up a little bit later on as well to continue our build-up to the All Blacks game this weekend. But it is going to be Portugal all the way for the first little while this morning. And you can get in touch with us on Twitter or on YouTube. It's going to be one of those Ask Kenny Anything mornings. Whether you've got any football questions, any food questions, any queries about life in general, we will take them and we will put them to the sage that is Kenny
non-sport,
Cunningham.
Non-sport, preferably.
How are you keeping?
Yeah, good.
You excited about this tomorrow night?
Yeah, I am. Haven't given it much thought, to be honest. It's kind of crept up a little, isn't it? Or it seems to have done so. But I am looking forward to the game, yeah. Full, not just a fact full house, but it'd be a really good game for us. A good indication in terms of exactly where we are in terms of the development of the squad, I think.
Gerr, how are you feeling on this Wednesday morning? What are we, 36 hours out from Ronaldo in town?
Yeah, I'm very excited about the game itself. I am concerned about the fact that there's a good possibility that we play well and still lose. I know Portugal have not been in brilliant form across the campaign. And just reading stuff from their manager in recent days, he said some weird stuff about Bernardo Silva. I don't know if he's getting the most out of his team, and I'm not sure if he has some of the same problems that Solskjaer has. But notwithstanding that, they could get three chances and score three goals. We could play really well and we could lose 3-0. So a range of outcomes are on the table again for this one.
Talk about not getting the most out of your players. Are we getting the most of Jerry this morning? But like staring him up at that little screen. What's going on there? Are we allowed to talk about this or are we just meant to ignore it?
I don't know. We do a bit of journalism.
I heard his voice and I was literally looking around the studio for 10 seconds to see where. I thought he was bending over tying his shoelaces.
Do a bit of journalism there, Kenny.
Shall I just let that one go? Shall I? There's no explanation forthcoming, Jerry. That's why you're not in studio this morning, huh?
I think his picture's after freezing, actually, at a convenient enough time.
Out of embarrassment. He's froze out of sheer embarrassment.
This
was sold to me this morning on the fact that Jerry and Owen in studio, the lads. The plural, the lads.
That's payments. That's your fee, getting to spend some time with two people in real life. We'll try and reestablish Jerry's line there. The general team, like, and I think there's actually... You don't want to jump in and make too many comparisons between the two big games in our sport this weekend, between the rugby and football teams, because they're at different stages and they're very different scenarios. But it does feel that there's like a general sense of maybe paranoia about the directions in which both teams are going. Paranoia may be a little bit too strong, but...
Massively too strong.
So basically the point I'm trying to make here is that, say you take the rugby team last weekend... They were good, but Japan were terrible. Take the football team. They've been good recently,
like
but
Qatar,
for example, Qatar were terrible. There was a general sense of, ooh, can we go all in on this? Can we go all in on saying that things are rosy in the garden? I think Portugal and New Zealand in rugby terms will probably frank that quite a bit.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think you have to factor in the quality of the opposition, but we should allow ourselves. I mean, it's been, from the footballing point of view, it's been tougher, isn't it? But tough for everybody, the viewing public, for them, the management team, the players, the pass. Kind of year to kind of 15 months, isn't it? So we should allow ourselves a little bit of celebration when the goals do start to flow, regardless maybe to a certain extent the quality of the opposition. But yeah, I think you do have to check it somewhat, temper the celebration in terms of the quality of the opposition. That's why I say this will be a far better test for the players against a good Portugal side. Not the type of team, to be honest, which is that frightened me. I've got to be honest with you. I fancied us a way there. We went away there. Not that I could say, like, for any obvious reason we went over there. I just thought it was a good time to get them going over there. I always found playing football when the group stages, like qualifying campaign started, if you had a big one in the group, which a big team, which invariably we did, that first game in the group when you got them early in the group qualifying stages, maybe just the kind of focus application wasn't quite there from the favourite team in the group, whereas when you got them further down the group, when they kind of get towards the business end, the game really mattered. Just found as if they were a slightly different beast when that second game rolled around. So that'd be the one little worry. So it's a big game for Portugal. They're kind of having an arm wrestle at the moment, aren't they, with Serbia for that top spot in the group, which is important. You don't want to be finishing second and going through the playoff system, wherever the hell that
involves.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, so I think they're focused there. They'll be spot on. They'll know the importance of the game. So, yeah, so it's all good. So, yeah, to answer your original question, yeah, very much looking forward to it for those reasons.
What is it about this particular Portugal team that gives you that slight sense of hope?
Just in terms of how they play, a lot of times I've seen them play the last few years, they can kind of, not a huge amount of intensity to their play at times, they can kind of play within themselves. We'll go as far as to say they're a moody old team, but they can play within themselves for large chunks of the game, and predominantly they've played like a kind of a counter-attacking game, not the type of team that kind of demand possession, they covet possession of the ball, they have to dominate you in terms of those possession stats. They're more than happy to give the ball to you and drop off into kind of a low defensive block, like, you know what I mean? So you feel as if at times you're very much in the game against them, because it wouldn't surprise me we have a fair amount of possession
right.
in the football against them, maybe 50%, maybe a little bit more. That really wouldn't surprise me. But they kind of let you have the ball and they'll drop down a gear or two, but obviously there's quality around the squad and they can hurt you, particularly on counter-attack. They're a physical side, aren't they? Physically kind of quite dynamic. If you look at the players, potentially they can put on the pitch the likes of Danilo Carvalho, Renato Sanchez in central midfield, kind of dynamic, physically imposing players, but not the most kind of dynamic, maybe highly technical of players. Now you could change that a little bit. You could put the likes of Neves in there and Bernardo Silva could change the dynamic a little bit. But yeah, I don't know what it is. Funny, isn't it? Just perceptions, really. You know, there's other teams out there, you know, they roll into Dublin, you think, oof, batting down the hatches, you know, get ready here. But Poland is good as some of the individual talent which they have, and they're pretty much like a club team in terms of how they set up. But they wouldn't scare me. So, yeah, I give us a fighting chance, absolutely, getting something from the game.
We're going to have plenty on this over the course of the next little while. OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. So, Ireland versus Portugal all the way up till 8:05 this morning. We'll be getting Kenny's thoughts on a few of the Premier League talking points as well, a few managerial vacancies, a few other things to get stuck into as well after 8:00. The sports page is coming your way at 8:25. Anthony Eddy's comments certainly causing a lot of traction over the course of the last couple of days, so we'll get stuck into them at around 8:25. Virtual Insanity with John Duggan, who is on a hot streak at the moment, coming your way at 8:25, and we will say goodbye, my sweet prince, to the European tour, and talk a little bit about the DP World Tour with John later on. Keith Wood coming your way at 9:05, and Damien and Dan coming up at 9:30. So that was the football show from last night. Damien Delaney and Dan McDonald will bring you that.
Keith's like the old sage, isn't he? When you roll him in there at about 9:00, it's a bit kind of helter-skelter prior to that. But then you roll out Keith just after 9:00 and the whole thing just drops down like calmness personified, isn't it?
It's just killing the tension.
Spiritual,
yeah.
It's almost like spiritual, isn't it, when he comes in?
Yeah, like a kind of a leader coming off the bench to just kind of nullify the threat of the opposition at 1-0 up.
Yeah, like kind of game management, that last
game management,
20 minutes of the game.
That was the phrase I was looking for. This is a lovely segue, Kenny. Thank you for this. Speaking of game management, tomorrow night, Kenny Cunningham, the point you make there about Ireland's possession is an interesting one, because obviously the situation in Faro was...
I'm talking to Jerry, by the way.
I'm here too, yeah. No.
You're seeing the back of my head here, Jerry.
It's funny, Kenny. I wish you could see what I can see. I've got you full screen, full glorious Technicolor, nothing but you. Because whatever, the camera... If you look straight at the camera right now,
it's this camera
right in front of you.
That's beaming to Jerry's house.
Now I'm looking at you.
You are.
Yeah, that's a conversation. I can't have a conversation with you parked on my left.
So if you look into this camera, everybody who's watching at home, Anger can see you. So that's it.
Right then,
now you and Jerry.
That makes no sense. I've just got to be honest. That makes no sense to me whatsoever.
I know, technology.
Direction.
It's a crazy thing, technology. I was going to ask you, Kenny, about the point you made. You're pretty boisterously hopeful about Ireland having a lot of the ball tomorrow night. Yeah.
Why would you say boisterous?
Because you said that the Republic of Ireland are going to have over...
This morning so far.
You're going to have over... You said the Republic of Ireland are going to have over 50% potentially of possession against Portugal.
I said they would have over...
You said there's a chance. You wouldn't be surprised.
Maybe. Potentially. They will.
Headline.
Maybe.
On OTB Sports. Ireland to smash Portugal. That's what I took from it.
That's hardly a headline. Like, I mean, you know, 40, 45, 50, 55, 60% for me is... you know, it's not a, that's not a huge factor in the game. Invariably, it's how you utilise possession of the football. And I've spoken already about Portugal. Sometimes they give you the ball. I don't think you can go blowing your trumpet against teams dominating possession of the ball when teams actually openly present the ball to you.
But the point I was going to make is that they had 27% of possession last time against Portugal. So why is it going to be different tomorrow night, do you suspect?
Well, I think the lads are in a better place, funnily enough, even off the back of the last two games. I think confidence is reasonably high. The football that we played was certainly more encouraging, creating more chances, obviously scored more goals. We've obviously checked the quality of the opposition, but even still, it was good to see players playing with a bit of confidence. And I think just playing together, I think certainly the starting 11 is coming together a little bit. I've said kind of Portugal, maybe 7-8 of their starting 11, they almost picked themselves. Well, we might be inching towards a situation like that ourselves, which maybe wasn't there 6-9 months ago in terms of which players would definitely be starters in the team. Now you look at the kind of keeper, back three, to a certain extent the wing-backs, although Stephen suggests that maybe Seamus and Matt will just play a game each in that right back wing back position. You know, Jeff Hendrick, possibly even Josh Cullen in midfield. There's players now, Callum Robinson up front, probably maybe now 7 or 8 players in the Ireland team, do you think? And while everybody turns up fit, these players are going to start. So little kind of partnerships are being established around the pitch, and that's important. That helps the kind of cohesion in the team, doesn't it, in terms of that kind of understanding of people around you, their strengths or weaknesses. So yeah, so I think that's all good. That goes in our favour.
It's just, like, I know I'm kind of obviously digging into something you said there a little bit too much, but it is interesting though, isn't it, the way Ireland have set up when they've got a lot of the possession and when they haven't had a lot of the possession. Like, it felt that counter-attacking against Portugal in Faro was relatively effective. Of course, Aaron Connolly's confidence maybe was shot a little bit. He went down a little bit too easily in the box, whereas in this occasion you have someone like Callum Robinson potentially in that role, which is one exciting factor if the game goes a similar way. And on top of that then, maybe there's a bit more confidence in the midfield as well, and the ability to control things on top of that a tad more.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, but I think Stephen Kenny's a manager. I don't think he'll accept going onto the pitch and, you know, maybe 30% possession of the football. I think he's the type of manager, he wants as much as possession of the ball that he can get. I think Stephen probably buys into the kind of philosophy of a lot of managers, full stop, and maybe a lot of the top managers, Guardiola in particular, that, you know, to kind of you know, keep the ball away from the opposition, negates the threat of the opposition if they haven't got the ball. Keep the ball for long periods, and you can't get hurt by the opposition. That's an obvious thing to say. So there is truth in it. So I think we will have a fair chunk possession of the football, and the encouraging thing is we have been reasonably effective with it the past. We have offered a threat. Some of the combination play has been good. We've mixed up our game quite well. Be interesting to see just those midfield and forward areas for me, just which balance he strikes in terms of personnel for this particular game. If you know, if Stephen thinks, well, counter attack is going to be an important factor in the game, well, the kind of counter attack effectively, particularly from a kind of lower defensive block, really you need pace in the team. So that means just injecting a bit of pace in those kind of midfield and forward areas. And I think the performance of Chidozie Ogbonna, wasn't it, last time around, gave Stephen food for thought. Jamie McGrath, very good athlete as well. You mentioned Callum Robinson, but I wouldn't necessarily say Callum Robinson is great. His strengths is maybe pace on the counter-attack. If you look at his performance against Qatar, it was interesting. He almost played as that false number 9, wasn't he? He played in the central attacking role, but he was kind of dropping off into the pockets, and that was the kind of trigger for Jamie and Chidozie to kind of spring in behind, use that pace to go in behind. I think that kind of worked quite well, as opposed to when Callum played away to Azerbaijan. He played right with three, didn't he? He had me to play down the middle, and him and Daryl Horgan kind of played off the sides. So that'd be interesting how the management staff see it in terms of the individual qualities of the personnel for this particular game, what kind of best suits the team.
What would you do?
What would you do?
Oh, there you go.
Well, I think if he goes to that kind of midfield two, which he has done the past couple of games, I think Jeff plays, because to be fair to Jeff, I think back-to-back has probably been his two best games in an Ireland jersey for quite some years. So I think off the back of those performances, he picks himself, Jeff, just his ability to get on the ball, that kind of ball retention you were talking about. But not just that, not just ball retention, just his ability to get into forward areas of the pitch and get in contact with that kind of front through and some clever little combinations, you know, and some kind of killer passes and that last towards the pitch. So Jeff's going to be important. So Jeff plays. I think probably Josh Cullen at the moment best compliments him, because I think Josh will naturally sit in a kind of a holding midfield position, that kind of defensive slot. I think he's comfortable there. I think he understands that role. So you can understand those two players kind of complement each other quite a bit. And then it's all about the front three. Callum Robinson obviously plays. I'd like to see Jason Knight. I know he hasn't been available, lads, for the past couple of games, but I like what I've seen from him in an Ireland jersey so far. Good technical ability. He's got the lungs of a racehorse, up and down. Very dynamic player. Kind of play. He's very versatile at the moment. He can play wide of a three. He can play in a central midfield position. He just looks to have a very good all-round game for me. He'll make a contribution in possession. He'll get himself forward in support of the attack. It looks as if he can score goals. But also, you don't carry him out possession either. Out possession, I think he's quite aggressive in terms of his defending. So he's one I'd like to see come into contention. I'm not too sure if Stephen will take that chance, considering his lack of game time. But he's a player I'd like to see come into contention. Maybe the likes of himself, Jamie McGrath and Callum Robinson as a front three. You know, Jason operating narrow off the right-hand side. Something like that for me. I think it probably is kind of as balanced as you're going to get. That might be a bit hard on Chidozie Agbonne, but I just think maybe his lack of experience, kind of big match experience, might just count against him.
So you're going Cullen and Hendrick. Like it does seem, maybe from everybody we've spoken to, we had Shane Keegan on yesterday, it could actually be Jamie McGrath versus Knight for that one spot alongside Ida and Robinson. Is that how you're seeing it as well, that it's lads fighting for that one spot?
Yeah, it could be. For me, it's more interesting, like, when we haven't got possession of football, how we play. Now, those arguments that you're making, I think, every one of them is valid in terms of, you know, when we're in possession of the ball and the qualities of those players that we're talking about, that's all very exciting. But I think for me, it's in terms of what defensive shape that we drop into once we haven't got the ball. If we play with that front three, say it is Adam Eder down the middle, Callum Robinson off the right and Jamie McGrath, I think how those wide players, it's so important in terms of the defensive positions they take up. I think they really have to narrow up into almost a defensive four, a midfield four defensive block when we haven't got the ball, because I don't think we can let Josh and Jeff get too exposed when we haven't got possession. I don't think we can send Jason Knight, Jay McGrath too high up the pitch, because they get played around. For me, there's too much space down the sides of our midfield too, which the Portuguese can exploit. So for me, it's about the information that's given to the players when we lose possession, those kind of transitions when we kind of give it away, or we just haven't got possession of the football. So important, those wide players, for me, get back and they narrow up and give Josh and Jeff, if that's who it is, in centre midfield, a little bit of protection. So we actually have a defensive block of five across the pitch, and we have kind of a narrow four in front of them with a lone striker. I think that's important. We'll need that really solid defensive block to kind of play from and hopefully counter from, which we haven't quite seen in the last two games. We haven't had to really had a lot of the ball. We've had it our own way, but a couple of times Azerbaijan, even Qatar, we kind of gave the ball away in their half the pitch, and very quickly they'd broken at us and very quickly got in deep into our half the pitch, and that can't happen. We need to be a little bit more structured in terms of how we defend over the course of 90 minutes for me.
What about Alan Brown? Because he's been a big favourite of Stephen Kenny's, and I would not be surprised if he's in the team. I'm just not sure. Does he play less as a number 10 and more as kind of an 8 in the constellation that you're talking about? So it's actually, it's less 3 up front, more 2 forward players and more 3. Obviously, Brown plays forward and can add an extra number. But so how would he work in the team if he does get picked?
Yeah, well, I think, again, there's that versatility as well. I think Stephen, with Alan, and I'm a big fan of Alan for the reasons you've said there as well, and he carries a real goal threat as well. Alan, what I like about Alan, he doesn't like overindulge himself in kind of central areas of the pitch. He's basically a central midfielder, number 10, a bit like you were saying, number 8, advanced number 8. But he doesn't always travel towards the ball. He doesn't like a huge amount of touches in the ball in those central areas. He's one of them, he's actually happy to run away from the ball. You know, get into advanced areas, get in contact with force, but get beyond them, run the space, run into the channels, arrive late into the box, almost minimal touches, but kind of maximum effect. So I think for that reason, he is a big asset. And to answer your question, if Steve was thinking, well, I'm going to play with two central midfielders and a narrow three up front, I think Alan probably plays as one of those front three players there off the side, just kind of narrowed up a little bit. But you're absolutely right. He's another one of those players, probably similar to Jason Knight. You think out of possession, you could drop into a defensive shape and you could trust him. I think you're right. I think he could tinker with it at times as well. With the likes of Alan Brown and Jamie McGrath, I think there's instances when you lose the ball, you can very easily get an additional forward back into midfield. So you can actually drop into a narrow midfield three when you haven't got the ball. And your two front players can just drop into a natural pairing. When you haven't got the ball, when you do have the ball, then you can kind of morph back into that kind of 5-2-3 shape. So I think with the actual formation, when you play with a back three and two wing backs, for me, this is what you can do. You know, you can kind of dovetail between them both. You can have that kind of midfield two and a narrow front three, and you know, plenty of movement, interchange of movement, which is great. But our possession, I'm talking about dropping the two wide men into a narrow midfield four. But you can very easily drop one into a narrow midfield three and keep a front two higher up the pitch as a pair. Yeah, more of a focal point for attack and even counter-attack. So that's kind of very interesting for me. That's what I'm kind of interested in seeing tomorrow against Portugal. And we need to get that right, because there can't be any indecision amongst the players when we lose possession. Are we pressing? Who's pressing? Are we going to go? It has to be a nice compact shape when we move up and down the pitch.
The way that you talk about the team with Knight in it, is it a team that's designed to press, or is it a team that's designed to sit back and absorb and hit in the counter-attack?
I think you can do both. Like, I think the likes of Jason Knight, you can do both, yeah. you can go and press to a certain extent. You don't have to. I mean, to press, it helps if you've got people who can travel at speed over 10, 15 yards, kind of high intensity, and do it continually. That's kind of the ideal if you're going to press. That's generally what has to happen. You know, you don't want to have too many one-pace players who find it a bit of a struggle to make those continuous sprints during the game. Jason Knight's a player who can kind of do that. Alan Brown, I think, can do that as well. That's what I'm talking about, maybe high energy. When you look at a team, I always try and get as much pace, high energy into the team for those kind of reasons that we're talking about. But I think you can do both. And I don't think it's just one way or the other, Jared, isn't it? The game will kind of dictate that in terms of where we are in the game. If we have to go press, like Manchester United the weekend, they're 1-0 down against Manchester City the first half of that game. So you're thinking, right, now this game is torn now from the start of the game. You're a goal behind. You need to grab the initiative now. You need to go and press, and you need to affect some turnovers. You need to force Manchester City into mistakes. You know, you need to apply some type of press. And it never happened, because for me, Manchester United, the team actually didn't look to me, they understood how they could go and win the ball back off Manchester City. There was no tactical plan there set up. There was no trigger in terms of how to break out from that defensive block, apply a bit of pressure, and actually win the ball back off Manchester City. There was just no basic understanding of how they needed to do that. So that's just the basic game plan. So I'm sure we'll kind of have that. And it might be a case of pressing them high up the pitch early on in the game, getting the crowd involved, you know, a lot of energy in the stadium. I suppose you want to feed off that to a certain extent. So you might see us early on operate a kind of a high press, you know, the whole team move up the pitch, try and win the ball back off Portugal in their half the pitch. There might be instances when we drop off into a lower defensive block, because maybe you have players likes of Alan Brown, Jason Knight, Chidozi, Ogbonna, who you think, you know, if we can just draw this team onto us, encourage them up the pitch, draw their fullbacks high up the pitch, maybe we can hit these teams effectively on the counter-attack. So that's just as the game evolves, players have to make those decisions themselves. I think the very good teams, they kind of dictate on the pitch. The manager sends you on the pitch, but the players themselves, as the game kind of progresses, they get a bit of an understanding of what they need to do to win this game, and players can make those adjustments themselves. But it's important to have players with those attributes on the pitch. Now, ideally, you can do both, Jared. You can go after James high up the pitch if you want, and if not, you can actually operate from a lower defensive block, and you can counter effectively with a bit of natural pace in the team.
Are you starting to see the game intelligence from the players who are in the team at the moment, being able to recognise in the real-time environment that actually this is a moment where we're pressing, this is a moment where we're sitting back, this is the counter-attack is on? Are we starting to see those patterns of play evolve?
Well, I think we'll see it more against Portugal. This is what I'm talking about, because I think we had our own way really in the last two games, Jerry, didn't we? Like inferior opposition. I don't think players, you have to wrestle with those questions too much against those teams. You're kind of dominating possession. You're having teams pretty much your own way. You can get a little bit lazy. I'm talking about a little bit open at times in terms of opening up the centre of the the pitch, throwing too many players into advanced areas because you're thinking, well, does it really matter? This team can't hurt us. Are they really going to hurt us? Have they got the pace to hurt us? Technically, probably not. I'll get back anyway. Somebody will give me a dig out. Those kind of thoughts go through your head. You get a little bit lazy against that kind of inferior opposition. But against a side of this quality, as good as these are, then you can't. Your decision making has to be absolutely spot on. So that's what I'm interested in terms of the information first and foremost that's given to the players in terms of how we're going to play, and in particular the kind of defensive structure of the team when we haven't got the ball. And also, yeah, you're right, having good decision makers on the pitch. And generally that comes from more experienced players, doesn't it, with the likes of kind of John Egan, Shane Duffy there, now even Jeff Hendrick in that central midfield position. They should be the players kind of really dictating. They're the players who can't really get a sense of the 20 minutes in, half an hour in, right, you know, opposition players, how they're playing, right, this is how we're going to get around it, you know what I mean? This is how we're going to get the better of them. This is what we have to do. You have to be patient. Maybe you have to be a little bit more aggressive and different in different parts of the game. So that's the interesting part of it, which would be good to see.
Who starts at left wing back for you?
Well, I think it's going to be, judging, you probably know more than me, but from what I read, Stephen was indicating that Matt or Seamus would play one game each as a right wing back. Obviously, injury concerns about them. They haven't had a huge amount of game time, so that would indicate that he might well do the same, a left wing back with James and maybe Enda Stevens over the two games. So yeah, I don't think it really. Matt's playing well. Seamus, we know his level of consistency. So, I don't think it matters greatly in terms of which of them occupied the right wing back role, and vice versa for James and Enda on the left hand side. James has done great there, isn't he? The last couple of games, and Enda's rock solid as well. You might argue in terms of maybe Seamus's defensive qualities. It's always the argument with Seamus and Matt, isn't it? We've been wrestling with it for the past couple of years, really, since Matt broke onto the scene, in terms of Seamus's probably defensive qualities in that area of the pitch, probably that little bit stronger. It's a natural thing, isn't it? Just Seamus, that side of his game is very good, defending 1v1 situations. His positional sense, I think, is very very good as well. You're defending that back post area, so maybe against a team of the quality of Portugal, you know, you're going to have to do your fair share of defending, maybe the manager might just lean towards Seamus in that kind of right wing back position, knowing that he can get forward very effectively as well.
The other thing, Kenny, we haven't spoken to you since Andrew Omabamadeli has, I guess, effectively become a Premier League starter for Norwich. Granted, it's only two games and the new manager could well change all that, but how has he fitted in at this level over the past couple of weeks?
Yeah, he's done great. That cameo appearance against Portugal, not easy coming onto the pitch in those circumstances. He done really well, and probably unfortunate to miss out in the game after that. It was the Azerbaijan game, was it, at the Aviva? Probably on reflection, probably a mistake to leave him out. But he's looked so comfortable. He's still learning, obviously. You know, he's young, but he's literally no experience whatsoever. He's getting some game time at Norwich now, which is good. Had a tough against Leeds due to a week. Found himself, just watched a bit of highlights of the game, found himself in a difficult position, isolated 1v1 against probably one of the most potent attackers in the game at the moment, Rafinha at Leeds, in the best form. So he had a difficult afternoon, but that's all part of the learning process. I'm sure he's quite smart. I'm sure he would have looked at the game, would have looked at his performance, analysed it, and that's how you get better. As a young defender, particularly in the Premiership. Still only 18. Is he still 18, lads? Is he
19? I think, is he
just 19? Yeah, he's just turned 19, is he? That's still very, very young playing at that level. Yeah. But I think he's shown some great attributes, and just how comfortable he is on the ball, and his ability actually to step forward into kind of those midfield areas and be positive with his passing, you know, be brave with his passing, you know, very easy to kind of step forward and as a centre half and end up playing that kind of square. You know, I was always very good at stepping forward into midfield, having a look it up, and, you know, just kind of pretending that
switching
you were pretending I was about to hit that killer ball. Yeah, go Robbie, go, I'm gonna hit that 50 yard, come on, man, go on, Robbie, come on. And then hit that 5 yard square pass at the end of it back to the centre half. But this lad looks a bit different. He's punchy with his pass, and he wants to play the ball forward. He kind of wants to kind of break the lines. He can actually travel in there as well, and that's what I think ideally that's what a lot of managers are looking for nowadays. Those back three defenders, the ability to not only to pass forward and break the lines with the pass, but actually travel into those midfield areas, commit players and open up space for us, and he can do that. So that's going to be a big asset to the team going forward. Because you look at kind of Shane's the more traditional type of defender, isn't he? John, to be fair to him, again, has got great defensive attributes, but John's very comfortable on the ball as well, to be fair to him. So yeah, you can't have enough of them, and there's a nice balance, that kind of back three at the moment, those three players, kind of nice bit of cohesion there. They look a tight little group, you know what I mean, and they're actually developing and understanding each other's games more and more.
Do you remember the 9th of February 2005, Kenny? A date that I'm sure comes to the tip of your tongue.
Valentine's isn't on the 9th of February, is it?
No, a few days away from that.
All right.
Republic of Ireland versus Portugal, Lansdowne Road, 44,000 people there. 1-0 win for the Republic of Ireland. Cristiano Ronaldo playing for Portugal. Andy O'Brien scored the winner for Ireland. You were playing.
Really?
You got taken off after an hour. Do you remember it?
I don't, no.
Right, well, that's it.
I don't remember the game. Ronaldo played 2016 years ago. Wow. Was he at United then, was he? Oh, right.
There you go, on screen for any of our radio listeners.
Never show him your number.
Cristiano Ronaldo.
First mistake.
You're showing him onto his left, I think, there. Maybe the picture doesn't do you any...
I didn't know very much. Showing him to his left there didn't make much difference, did it? That never show an opposition player your number. Look.
Right.
That's exactly what I'm doing. I think I'm actually off the pitch there. I think he's twisted me up that much. I'm about 5 yards off the pitch there. About to run down the tunnel.
Does it ring a bell at all? Playing this kid Ronaldo.
No.
This team.
No, that day.
That
no.
Half and half shirts.
Yeah, it's an interesting jersey, all like that, isn't it? Is that black and white? Was he at United then? Had he signed? Yeah, did he?
Yeah, yeah. Hadn't he?
Oh, I don't. And that was a qualifying game, was it?
No, it was a friendly.
Oh, that was a friendly, was it?
Yeah, it was a friendly. So, yeah, he was at Manchester United coming up to 2 years at that point. So he was well established. And
I'm looking at the Ireland jersey at the time. Can't get a good view of it there, can you? Hmm. Looks one of the better ones, doesn't it?
Yeah,
that little white kind of strip, was it underneath the
arm?
The armpit, was it?
Yeah, it was the Umbro kit, but. Yeah, I think we'd Brian Kerr on the show a couple of months ago before the first Portugal game, actually, and he certainly remembers the game, even though you don't. It was a decent team. Deco was playing, Paulo Ferreira playing.
Deco?
Yeah.
I thought you meant for us. Deco made his debut. Yeah. Sheriff Street, North Dublin. Bring me there for a minute.
Other than not sure.
So did I.
I was thinking Deco. Who's
other than not showing a fantastic player your number, how do you prepare, or how do you operate in game when you're up against a talismanic player? Clearly Ronaldo wasn't that talismanic, if you don't remember it at that
try not to
in time.
Operate in the same space as those talismanic yeah. players generally.
Yeah.
I generally try to put as much distance between myself and those individual players.
You mentioned a moment ago, like that Roman Babadeli had to, like he was given the responsibility of taking on Rafinha that day against.
Well, that's the thing. He clearly wasn't. It ended up that way, and that was the kind of problem against players of that particular quality. And obviously, Ronaldo's an exception, but I had it all Jordan, me career. You just can't allow yourself, you know, to be left in 1v1 situations. You have to know your. The individual qualities which I have, and just as importantly, your limitations. And very early in my career, I was very much aware of the limitations which I had. So there's no point in me giving it to, you know, Charlie Biggs, but oh yeah, I'll go and take, you know, Chris Ronaldo, whoever it is, on a 1v1 situation. Just end up embarrassing yourself. So the solution was always in the collective for me, you know, not so much as a team, but really the players around you. I would have played left side of centre half a lot for Ireland. So for me, it was all about me left back and the centre half alongside me. That central midfielder, particularly, who was closer to me in front. And really, collectively, how we could go about maybe nullifying the threat of somebody in that area of the pitch, whether it was, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo or everybody else. Henry is probably the best example of somebody, of a player who you just. Coming onto the pitch, I was literally, it was like literally just scratching your head. Like, it was like the Three Stooges coming onto the pitch, I was. because there was no way you knew there was no way I could deal with him in a war. I just couldn't allow myself to get into a situation where I was isolated. I hadn't got somebody within 10-15 yards of me on the pitch. It literally couldn't happen because he was that quick over the ground, that dynamic. He literally just embarrassed. I couldn't do anything. Couldn't body check him. You know, I couldn't, show me number. It didn't matter, like, somebody, you know, had those kind of athletic qualities. So you just got to recognise that, and you have to kind of not just modify your game, but it's, for me, it was always about vocal communication, people around you. Look, this is what needs to happen. You need to narrow up. We need to drop off. Mark, you need to screen me there in front, right side of centre half. You need to give me a bit of cover if I go in close with him. So the solution was always in the collective in terms of how you tried to nullify those players. It was for me anyway. Some players are blessed with great individual qualities. Well, some defenders. Van Dijk's probably the best example of it in the modern game. I don't think Virgil van Dijk loses too much sleep going onto the pitch most Saturday afternoons, or certainly prior to his injury, in terms of being left 1v1 situation against any forward player in the world. And that's a beautiful place to be in mentally when you understand the qualities which you have. And really, there's little or no players out there who have the ability to kind of to get the better of you in those 1v1 situations. That's a real luxury to have. So the majority of players, and certainly I was one of them, didn't have that luxury. So you need to find the answers. You need to find the answers from somewhere. And invariably that's it. Just basically hiding in the shadows a lot of the time. But yeah, just looking for your mates to give you a bit of a dig out. That's what it is, really, isn't it? Fundamentally, what it comes down to at the end of the day, you know, bailing each other out, you know, just operating as that kind of pack, that kind of siege mentality to try and nullify the threat.
And is it something in training in the week of facing Henry that you're having those conversations with your teammates, or is it just kind of like you need to have that telepathy almost built up over a period of time?
Yeah, but it's just common sense. Someone like him, it's just, you know what's coming, you know what I mean? You just know what's coming down the track. You know, these kind of players just really don't disappoint you. So yeah, it's not about a tactical master plan at the start of the week and training day to day how you're going to deal with them. But yeah, you would have those conversations with teammates, particularly in the hours leading up to the game, maybe over poached eggs and beans at breakfast. all the defenders would get together. We wouldn't be that hungry, funny enough, on the day of a game against Thierry Henry. Everybody would be pushing their food around the plate for about 20 minutes. But yeah, he would. And it'd be just those things, those normal comments, no great tactical master plan, just like, listen, lads, don't leave me 1v1 with this fella today. Like, and there's plenty of them around. He wasn't the only one.
But they
one.
All did.
Sorry?
They all did. Every team in the world had that experience. I'd say every centre-back in the world who faced Thierry Henry around that time had the same experience, because no matter how fast you are, he was still faster.
Yeah, but we've got lucky a little bit, Henry, to be honest with you, because he had this kind of, say, a tendency, but it's really how he played. He kind of played, he was kind of a centre-forward, really, lads, wasn't he? But for a lot of the time, he operated in that left wing position, really, didn't he? He had his tendency just to drift that inside left, almost to a left wing position. Like to pick the ball up there and then kind of drive in field. Now, that's pretty common nowadays. People play with front three, right-sided player playing off the left. It was really, a lot of times they're centre-forwards now. They're very comfortable receiving the ball wide and driving on the inside onto their favoured right foot, aren't they? And that's quite typical. That's not unusual now, is it? Oh, a right-sided player playing on the left wing. This is like amazing. But back then, it was a little bit. It was like, ooh. But to be honest with you, it suited me down to the ground. To be honest with you, when he used to start drifting over onto right back at the time, it was like, oh, happy days. Off you go. But he had that tendency to go and do that, of course, when he picked it up. But then, of course, when he started driving in field and he was coming straight at you like a runaway train, then it was different then. Like, but yeah, they're the challenges that you face, particularly at kind of a league competition. And the lads will have those. Not so much Ronaldo, because he's a different beast now, lads, isn't he? That picture you show there, Lansdowne, he's on the move there, isn't he? He's on the move, he's twisting and turning. He had that acceleration over 10-15. He had everything, didn't he, you know, back then. But which he hasn't got now. He hasn't got those different type of player now.
There was a thing during the week about which footballer would you like to have seen win the European Footballer of the Year award, and it was a picture of Lewandowski, because they didn't have it the year France football, the proper one, yeah. They didn't have it the year that he was going to win it. And the first answer I saw that made any sense was Thierry Henry, who actually never won it. In a weird way, was Thierry Henry somewhat underrated?
Yeah, no, I don't think he was underrated. I don't think generally, he certainly wasn't underrated in terms of players who've obviously played with him alongside. I don't think he was underrated generally. Certainly the time he was at in the UK, Jared, the kind of media over there, it was a maybe not a proper love in, because he always had that, side of his personality, didn't he? There was always something there, that little bit of arrogance that just rubbed people up, wasn't it? And probably opposition players as well, because he had that little thing about him. And I remember,
the collars were up.
Sorry?
The collar was up.
No, it wasn't even so much. Cantona had the collar up. But Cantona is a good comparison, actually. I'd say you ask like players, and I'm not talking about players who played with, opposition players who played against, say, Cantona, and obviously everybody would be agreed, world-class player. But there'd be a huge, like, I'd say real warmth towards Cantona from opposition players. Like, actually, kind of, not maybe I loved him a little bit too strong, but, you know, really regarded him as a player, personality, how he kind of carried himself on the pitch. There was no, you know, no messing with him, really, like, you know what I mean? He had that side to him, had a physical side to him, he could look after himself, all and that. But he kind of played the game, a bit of a man's man, that type of player, wasn't he? So he would have had a huge respect on that level as well as his qualities as a player. Henry was always a little bit different. Yeah, he had that little bit of it, and I remember playing him a couple of times, and you couldn't tackle Henry. I've probably said this maybe once before. I mean, you couldn't tackle him. I mean, if you tried to make, he had the ball into his feet in the centre half, he got tied to him, you tried to make it. I'm not talking about going to the back from there, Jair. I'm talking about maybe just to have a nibble. Just try and maybe toe poke the ball away to prevent him getting turned and running at you. Have a little toe poke, and you might brush against his ankle or something, make a small bit of contact with him. Suddenly he was like, he could, you know, he was up and he was looking, he was staring you down as if, you know, what are you doing? I mean, you've tackled me there, you caught me. You know, what are you doing? This type of thing, like, as if you can't tackle me. That he had that about him, and that kind of rubbed. I remember laughing at him a couple of times. Say, oh, come on, you'd laugh at him. You think, doing me as if he'd no comprehension. And what do you mean? What were you tackling? We're not going to lay a glove on you. We're going to let you turn and have things all your own way. But he didn't like it. That kind of aggressive. Now, he wasn't like Meek. Don't get me wrong. He was a top class player. For a reason, in terms you kind of couldn't bully him, but he didn't like it. He had that kind of little bit of arrogance about him, which other players, and certainly Cantona, didn't have. So I always felt players were a little bit, yeah, begrudging Henry. Yeah, top class, world class player. But
because I'm looking at the list of winners from, so he kind of comes to consciousness around 98, right? So he wasn't the best player.
The Ballon d'Or you're talking about, Jared. The Ballon d'Or.
Yeah, Zidane wins 98. Rivaldo wins 99. 2000, Luis Figo. 2001, Michael Owen wins it. Ooh. 2002, Ronaldo. 2003, Nedved. And Thierry Henry is second. And he's 60 votes behind Nedved. And that's kind of the end of him being in competition for that, really. So, sorry, he finishes third in 2006. Maybe if they win the World Cup, Cannavaro wins it. Maybe if they win the World Cup, he gets more votes. I don't know. But it's just, it feels like that's the type of thing that he was the best player in Europe for a couple of seasons.
Yeah, but that's too easy, Jer. You can't just say he was the best player 10 years, so he should have won one of those. You have to look at, I mean, it is the calendar year, the Ballon d'Or? I'm not quite sure the criteria.
Pretty sure it is.
Michael Owen winning it. Come on.
Yeah, Michael Owen. Well, exactly. Like, now, I'd be the same to you. Or Michael Owen, Thierry Henry. Who's the best player there?
Who are you picking? Get your life.
If you're asking me who's the superior player, I pick Henry. But if you ask me that particular car, what was Michael Owen doing that particular? Obviously, he was in terms of goals.
He scored the goal in the cup final, and there was some weird.
The FA Cup final.
I wouldn't factor that in too much.
That's it. That was a famous goal. It was like Houllier, and he obviously scores the hat trick in. Is it in Wembley or is it in Germany against Germany? They win 5-1, and Heskey scores.
Was that a friendly game? Was that a competitive game?
No, it was the day we beat Holland. Forget this in Ireland. He scores a hat-trick against Germany.
Yeah. I mean, I take your point. It's not an argument, is it? You know, who would you have?
No, it's weird. I
think it's timing, like, a lot of these things. I think it's just, and other things as well. I think a lot of things are factored in. I'm not quite a big believer in, they won the European Championships that year. Like, you hear it now with kind of Jorginho. He's got to be favourite. He's won the Euros with Italy and he's won the Champions League with Chelsea. And I'm like, well, yeah, I understand his club and his country won those tournaments, but how did he play in the final? Yeah. Is that not more significant, how he actually played in the final? The fact he got dragged after, he obviously didn't get dragged, I'm exaggerating here, but the fact he got dragged after 60, but that's not a factor. They're just the same one. I mean, that makes no sense to me whatsoever. You just have to look at it in terms of high level performance during the course of that year. And yeah, obviously in the big games come around, and if they perform in those big games, yes, it's a factor. So all of those things, but you're right, it does sound a bit of an anomaly. That maybe that's a part of it, why Henry never got, he rubbed everybody up.
Well, the thing
rubbed
is,
everybody
I
up
think,
the wrong
I
way
think, I think you're I think that's very interesting that you brought that up, because I'd completely forgotten about that aspect of his character. And actually, but, of course it matters. It's a popularity
it's
character.
Hold on a minute, yeah. You talk about somebody rubbing people up the wrong way. Ireland's opponent tonight, Cristiano Ronaldo, has got 5 Ballon d'Ors, and him rubbing people up the wrong way, him having his collar up, him going down after a breath of air on his ankle doesn't seem to have harmed
him. Yeah, but 60 goals a season. 60 goals a season is going to do it for you. Winning the Champions League at Real Madrid is going to do it for you.
Existing in the same sphere as Lionel Messi, Henri didn't have to exist in the same sphere as Lionel Messi. The competition was easier for Henri.
There's been significant lobbying on the part of Ronaldo and his sponsors to try and get him to win this competition. You know, I'm not saying they were buying votes, but
devil advocate here.
A little bit of pressure was put on the electorate. American electoral system.
I don't think Ronaldo's on that level in terms of Henry, to be honest with you. Again, when Ronaldo was operating, there was a little bit of that initially when he was at Manchester, you know, it was a little bit of that diving and all that theatrics. But I think he came out with that, to be fair. I think he matured a little bit. I think the penny dropped. I think the lads got in his head a little bit. So it was always there a little bit around it, but I think he kind of came out with that a little bit, to be fair to him, Ronaldo. And it's just those, yeah, but you're saying, oh, Ronaldo, 5 Ballon d'Or, but those numbers, you can't get away from those numbers really, on, can you, in terms of what he's been doing for the majority of his career and the level he's been, the consistency and the level where he's been doing. I mean, Lewandowski's an interesting one you've mentioned there, Jer. I mean, he's probably a little bit unlucky in terms of, he broke Gerd Müller's record there, didn't he, wasn't it, last year, in terms of goals for Bayern Munich, was in the Bundesliga, you know, ridiculously consistent in terms of goals scored. And but there's always that Bayern Munich, the Bundesliga. But I think there's an argument, but I think that's fair argument in terms of how kind of dominant that team have been in that league. And maybe to a certain extent during that period of time, the general quality of that league in comparison to La Liga or maybe the Premier League. So for me, that is a fair argument, Jared. All of those things you have to roll in. And obviously you know, he's done it everywhere in terms of, you know, Spain. We know I don't have to say it, like, so.
I think Owen's
clutching, obviously, basically. I think that's what I'm
just saying that Thierry Henry was the greatest player in the world for a few years and deserved at least one of them. It is 8:17, you're with us here on ODBAM with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. Before we go to ads, Kenny, the OTB photo department have been digging up pictures. You mentioned Eric Cantona, collars up. Wimbledon versus Manchester United here in the Premier League, 95-96. There you are.
That's what I'm talking about. The collective, you know, the collective trying to work together.
A little bit of
it didn't work there.
A fresh faced Hugh Grant look to Kenny Cunningham there, standing in the background.
What's that look on your face?
I think it's the look on Chris Perry's face, which I think is the more appropriate. Like, he's looking at me looking more disappointed with me than I am with him. I've got that little bit of a more of an apologetic look on my face, as if, sorry lads,
is that what that is? I told you.
Yeah, no, that's got more of it. Sorry,
you
lads.
You let Cantona get free at the back. He's going to score. I told you. Over the eggs this morning and the beans when you were shoving them around the place. I said, don't let Cantona get free. I told you. That's what that place looks to me.
It's the third goal you'd conceded that day. Eric Cantona obviously celebrating after scoring the winner.
I didn't begrudge Eric. I got to be honest with you. Henri would have hurt. It would have bored me a little bit. But, you know, Eric, now you could have the adulation.
A bit more genuine.
Top man, yeah.
You're just not anti-French in general, is what you're trying to say here.
Not at all. Christophe Dugarry, one of the greats. So I played with French internationals when he came to Birmingham. Great lad.
Right.
Oh, great lad. Lovely fella. Great sense of humour. Very quirky in his nature, which I liked as well. His own man. Didn't bow to anybody. Wonderful player. Liked a little night out. Sensible, don't get me wrong.
You'd collect him in the Mondeo?
He had his own show. He didn't have his own show for it. That was the beauty about him, Christophe. You wouldn't have known. You know, walking around the place. He was one of these kind of Ford Cortina jobs, and didn't overdo it in the fashion stakes. You know, just kind of blended.
you know, very kind of grounded, very grounded individual, but like very funny lad, and what a player. And we might have spoken about him before. I think we spoke about him before, didn't we? How good he was. Didn't realise how good he was. Yeah. And he was another one. You loved him. Teammates, players, absolutely loved him. It's a bit of an ego there, don't get me wrong, but in a kind of good way. You know, some people have that ego and they're quite funny with it in terms of how they use it. Some people have the ego and it's how they carry it, isn't it? It kind of, we're talking about Henri, it kind of rubs you, doesn't it? But others have that ego, but it's different though how they carry it. It's kind of, kind of use it in a kind of funny way, like, you know what I mean?
Jim Gavin said everybody has a sense of ego, and it's how you actually manage that and how your self-worth is actually utilised for positivity rather than being like, oh, big
bloody hell, really, can you write that down? Can you type that out, what Owen just said there? I'll take it away with me today and I'll study it. I'll study it this afternoon. I'll write a thesis up. I'll write a 300-word dissertation on that, what Owen's just said there.
It's just dawned on me that there's a great game that we can play here some morning where we just compile a list of Frenchmen and we get Kenny Cunningham to go great lad or not a great lad. So we'll have that ready next time. Great lad, not great lad. Coming next time, Kenny Cunningham.
I was actually paying you a compliment. I was paying you a compliment there, Owen. You just lost me after about like 3 seconds.
No, it's okay.
I couldn't absorb everything that you were saying. It was very highbrow, Jay. I needed you here.
Our audience,
Jay,
well,
I needed you here in the studio.
To bring things back down.
Basically, yeah, exactly.
We think popular, Owen. Move on.
Okay, right. Liverpool fans will not want to miss our latest Cadbury FC roadshow. We have been behind the scenes at Anfield with legendary striker Robbie Fowler, and we were also joined by Liverpool captain and Ireland international Niamh Fahey and former Liverpool midfielder and physio Richie Partridge. It's all with thanks to Cadbury FC and their club partnerships, granting you behind the scenes access at the Premier League's biggest clubs. That Robbie Fowler interview is live now, and during the break you'll see a preview of that conversation. We'll be back in a few with more from Kenny.
OTB AM.
Welcome back. It is 8:23. You're with us here on OTB AM featuring Kenny Cunningham for the morning. We've done plenty of build up to the Republic of Ireland against Portugal tomorrow night. Just wanted to do a few Premier League talking points, Kenny, if that's okay with you. A couple of managerial vacancies. It is sacking season, as they call it. Two big names, obviously, dropping out of the Premier League over the last couple of days, Dean Smith and Daniel Farke, obviously. We might start with that Aston Villa appointment. And in fairness, the Norwich appointment kind of plays into this, because what you've got is Steven Gerrard and Frank Lampard both being linked with both of these jobs. Steven Gerrard, you said to us a couple of weeks ago, it would not be a good career move for him to go to Newcastle United. Are you looking at this differently if it's Aston Villa?
You quote me again.
Absolutely. Paraphrasing you.
Paraphrasing. That means, quote me, inaccurately. Is that what the paraphrasing means?
It's just summing up what you said. not droning on like you, but giving your point.
What I said incorrectly. You know, I think the there was indicators this morning, I think, people surrounding Steven Gerrard suggested he would be interested in speaking. Am I correct in saying that? Or did I just dream that last night? I'm only up about an hour, to be honest. But
no, it would be quite a boring dream, so let's take that as fact.
Yeah, so if that is, that does, I can understand it, and I can understand obviously with a chase and Gerrard. Like I said, I probably said it here in terms of the job that he's done up there, really impressed how well he's done up there, how quickly he's turned kind of that club around Rangers. I think it's been really impressive. And for me, always not even so much the elephant in the room with Gerrard, and it must be the case with our Liverpool supporters, is the potential for him to arrive back at some point to Anfield. There must be an ambition there from Gerrard to do that. I'm sure for the majority of Liverpool supporters, unless I've got this wrong, lads, there's a desire for them to see him back there. And once that's in place, in terms of that kind of burning, yearning desire amongst the supporters, invariably the kind of owners and the people in power at the club generally fall in line with that at some point. It's in their best interest to do that. So I think it's about the stars coming into alignment. So the conversation's always with Gerrard for me. You always have to reference Liverpool. It's amazing, isn't it? We're talking Liverpool and Gerrard and Aston Villa, but invariably I can't stop talking about Liverpool in terms of career path.
Yeah.
What are you laughing at, Jay?
Bad idea. Spit it out. Bad idea for Villa.
Oh, Villa man. Exactly. I was wondering why he was getting so stressed. I could tell.
This is like...
He was getting all fidgety. He's getting all fidgety there.
Let's be a training ground for another team in the Premier League. What? No. Let's find our own manager and our own identity and somebody who wants to come and stay for a long time with the club and build something. What you're doing, if you get Steven Gerrard, there's two scenarios. One, he bombs out and fails and you've been the experimental ground for Liverpool and it's like, they're great. Two, he's really good and he stays two seasons and then leaves because he wants the Liverpool job. It's like, lads, what are you doing?
Two seasons is a long time in football.
I think you take that at the moment. You take two successful seasons at the moment, Jerry, wouldn't you? The direction
that's the point. Then you're baking yourselves in as nothing.
Who are you beating the drum for here? Like Neil Warnock. Neil Warnock, is it? You want more Neil Warnock?
I'm beating the drum for them to go off and find somebody who can come and build a culture and use all the money they have, because they've got a decent amount of money.
So any manager who's got any type of ambition to manage at the very highest level, you want to dismiss them straight away. Basically, that's what you're saying. Any young manager's got an ambition to manage at the highest level, forget about it. We don't want ambitious young managers at Aston Villa Football Club. Let that be known.
We don't want them coming in and going, I like you, but I like this one over here much better.
That's what I'm saying.
That's my long-term relationship goal here.
That's what I'm saying. That's not what he's saying.
You're just a casual Friday night out. That's all this is.
Oh dear, you can't win, can you?
You need to kind of know your place here a little bit, Jerry, I think, with Aston Villa. I mean, if you want...
Exactly, Owen. Let's bake in the hierarchy. Let's have that post-colonial inferiority complex. Let's do that. We're just us. Thanks, sir. Jesus, you might come and write us for a couple of years and then you'll go off and write somebody else.
A couple of years is a long time to be written.
Well, if you look
that's
at the...
That's
Yeah, but if you... It's interesting because... I take the point of what you're saying, because for me it's the same, but I think almost from Aston Villa's point of view, you've almost kind of turned that into a positive. You've got a player coming down who he'll never admit it publicly, but whose clear ambition is one day to manage Liverpool Football Club. How's he going to do that, Jer? He's not going to do that by coming to Aston Villa and doing a bog standard job at Aston Villa. The only reason he's going to bounce from Aston Villa to Liverpool, in my opinion, is to be a big success at Aston Villa. And that's by taking Aston Villa where they are at the moment, pushing them in not only to the top half of the table, but towards those European places, towards that top 6-8. That's the only chance for me, if he makes the move to Manchester, to Aston Villa, that he's got a bounce into Liverpool after that. So that's the good thing. So that's his motivation going there, his ambition. He's going to be fully focused at Aston Villa and do the best for Aston Villa Football Club. For that reason. Now, you may not like that. Oh, is he really doing for Aston Villa? Is it all about himself? Of course it's all about himself. It's always about yourself as a player or as a manager. That's just a fact. That's human nature. But the fact is, if he's successful there at Aston Villa Football Club, if he turns that club around to an extent and gets ahead in the right direction, and if his motives are for what we're saying in terms of potential that move down the road, Aston Villa are going to reap the rewards. Now, for me personally, I would still argue if he wants to make that big step to Liverpool, I don't think Aston Villa is the way to do it. I still feel as if he sits tight at Rangers Football Club, say for the next kind of 2 years, two and a half years, Jer, and he maintains the level of success that he's had up there, back-to-back league titles, cup wins, whatever, and has some degree of success in European competition, which, to be fair, he isn't going to have at Aston Villa. He's not going to come out of Aston Villa in 2.5 years' time with the Liverpool hierarchy looking at him saying, well, that was that Champions League run he had at Aston Villa last year, well, that's made our mind up. We're going to have him. It's not going to happen, Jared, is it? But it could happen at Rangers. It might be a case of, well, getting through that Europa stage, getting to the quarterfinals of the Europa, like that's amazing. That proves as if that he's capable, his tactical understanding, what's required in European competition. He's proven that at Rangers. He's proven he can win league titles at Rangers. For me, that's still a stronger argument from bouncing to Liverpool from Rangers than it is at Aston Villa. Because you know how difficult that is. I'm talking about Aston Villa top six, top eight. That's not easy, Jared, is it?
In two and a half years,
even with money behind them, in terms of the quality of opposition there at the moment, you look at the top six, seven, eight teams in the Premiership and the backing they have at the moment. Forget about the top four, Jared. The likes of kind of Leicester City,
West Ham,
Arsenal look as if they're in a better place now.
Arsenal
Spurs are going to trouble. Everton. West Ham, exactly. Yeah. Like, it's not easy, Jared. Like,
even
get to the top of that little mini group.
Top half is a good finish almost for Arsenal.
Yeah, exactly. Like, now you're telling me, you know, Liverpool are going to be looking at Gerrard 2 years. Well, do you know what? 11th place, 12th place, Aston Villa in the Premier League. That's, you know what the money men are like. You know what I mean? Looking at all the stats, all the tick box, and that's not great. And we're taking a mid-table manager here. Don't see the bigger picture. But I think it'd be more impressive with a man who's bought back-to-back, maybe three league titles in 4 years at Rangers, won a couple of competitions and gone deep into Europe in one or two occasions, I think that'll appeal to them more, wouldn't it? I think they'll be kind of starstruck by that a little bit, rather than in terms of that kind of relative success which he's enjoying at Aston Villa. So that's a lot of talking there for me. But basically what I'm saying is, from his point of view, I can understand it. Villa are a very great club, Jerry. He's coming back into the Premiership. He's a real competitor, Gerard, isn't he? The opportunity to come back and compete against those teams that we've spoken about. Big hike in terms of wages, money. Oh, he doesn't need money. He's got a load of money. Money's money. We know that. Money will be a factor. He'll have money to spend. He'll back the most exciting, the most talked about league in the world. All of that.
The Liverpool fans twice a year will get to give him a massive standing ovation. He'll get to. I think that's important. He doesn't get that from anybody in Scotland, you know?
Yeah, but that's all part of it. So I can understand. Yeah. I can understand that, you know, pushing aside the Liverpool. For me, I can't get away from that. That Liverpool thing is always there, isn't it? It's always lingering in the background. And I don't think, if you're looking at it purely from that point of view, from Gerrard's point of view, how do I plot my way back to Liverpool Football Club in the next 3 to 5 years? Is anybody thinking Klopp's going to be there in 5 years? No. Oh?
Well, not a chance, no.
Gerrard?
No, I think that. I think maybe 3 years.
2-3 years, maybe.
Yeah.
Fair? Reasonable?
Yeah.
No,
Don't overthink it, Gerrard.
He might turn into Ferguson. If I was him, it's the best job of all time. I would just be the new Ferguson. Like, you know, it's always going to be a team that's capable of being competitive. And his energy isn't about, you know, I think he could sustain it if he wanted to, but I'm not sure.
I think 3 years.
I think on balance, no. Yeah. You're right.
So I'm thinking, so for me, so a body of work for me, that body of work where he's in the process in up at Rangers Football Club, for me, that would be sufficient. As long as there was that real, that desire was still there amongst Liverpool supporters, and also to a certain extent at the board, yeah, we would like, and they're looking for an excuse to bring him in. You know, they don't want to be ridiculed by bringing Steven Gerrard in and all people immediately. This is a joke. Oh, what are you bringing this kid in for? He's done nothing in. So they're obviously looking for reasons, and the reasons for me are those league championships up in Scotland, cup competitions, have an impact in Europe. I think that's going to be sufficient, even in 2-3 years' time, to get him a real shot at the Liverpool job. I think he's taking a risk in terms of this job. That's no disrespect to Aston Villa. I think he's taking a calculated risk. It might come off. He might surprise us. Or he might do a Leicester. There, propel them up to the top four, do a kind of Brendan Rodgers to an extent. But Aston Villa, in terms of personnel, aren't in the same position that Leicester were in terms of quality of individual players when Rodgers came into the club. So I think it's fascinating, and I'd love to see him come down. I've got to be honest with you. I'd love to actually like to see him take the job and just see how he does. Watch him up close, Jer. See really how good a manager that he is.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that one plays out. So you would suggest that he stays at Rangers for himself? For
I was trying to convince a Man United supporter last night. Sorry, Alan jumped in. I was trying to convince Spin the Line last night that Manchester United were seriously looking at Gerrard.
What was the response there?
As a negative, I wouldn't let it go, to be honest. I was trying to keep a straight face. I was trying to... And the kid was only about 9-10 years of age, to be honest with you, so I didn't want to labour it too much. But I didn't want to devastate him too much, but I thought I'd sling that one out there anyway. I thought I'd start the rumour mill on that one.
We were having a conversation yesterday with Phil Kenny about Chelsea and about the title contenders in general. I think Gerrard and Phil were maybe on the same page here, that Chelsea's title credentials maybe were a little bit overemphasised at the start of the season, and now we're starting to see a little bit of a chipping away at this air of invincibility, and that if any team is going to go on a big run this season, it's going to be Manchester City. What have you made of Chelsea's recent stutter?
Yeah, I think Jenny, that's all it's been. Yeah, no, I wouldn't agree with that. I wouldn't agree with that from Jerry. I understand to some extent in terms of that little bit of a drop off, but I just think, Jerry, in terms of you look at who's out at the where they are, and actually who's out and who can actually come back into the team, they can get even stronger. Lukaku comes back into that team, they're stronger straight away. Now he hadn't scored for a couple of games prior to his injury, but they're more a potent threat. They got more goals than when he plays. Pulisic is another player for me. I think at the start of the season, Jerry, if you'd have said to me their two most important attacking players when Lukaku came into the club. It would have been Pulisic and Lukaku. I know Mason Mount had a great end to the season, don't get me wrong, but it would have been Pulisic and Lukaku in terms of a title challenge. These two lads are going to be absolutely pivotal. I think people forget how good a player that Pulisic actually is. He literally just hasn't been available so far this season. So those two players coming back into the team, Jay, and getting some significant game time and staying injury free, for me that elevates Chelsea even more so. So that's the scary thing, and that's why for me they've always been tight challengers. I wouldn't have them up there at the start of the season. This team's untouchable, but you can't pull them apart. You know the reservations I have in terms of Chelsea slot, you know, that kind of central midfield area, kind of defensive frailties for me that I see in terms of Jorginho when Kante isn't there alongside him. I think it's a very slight soft centre to the team, but you can't get too fixated on that in terms of the quality which is around it, the defensive organisation, the amount of clean sheets which they're keeping, and I just think there's more to come from this Chelsea team, and that's a good thing to say, you know, kind of 3 months into the season, sitting at the top of the league, or kind of 3-point league.
Yeah, look, I'm not exactly arguing from a position of strength here, and just to go back to an earlier team, I was paraphrased clearly there, Kenny. They're just, you know, whether or not it was,
really,
whether or not there was.
I hear your pain. I hear your pain, Jer.
Listen,
I hear your
pain. No, I don't do quoting. I just throw people under the bus.
My point is that there was definitely people were like writing in pen Chelsea winners of the league, and actually there's a flakiness in the team. There's an injury profile of Pulisic in particular and some of those other forward players that doesn't guarantee they're going to be consistent over the course of the year. And it's not just because they won last season's Champions League, completely different competition, it doesn't automatically mean that they're going to be consistent over the course of the league. They're definitely going to be one of the genuine title contenders who lasts till the end of the season. I would still make City favourites because I think that the talent pool in City is significantly better at still than the one at Chelsea, and they're further down the line. That's not to say Chelsea won't become a dominant team in two or three seasons, but I don't feel like they're there yet. And he's only had, what, one transfer window properly to kind of get the players in that he wants. Again, the Lukaku thing, like obviously he had a brilliant time at Inter, but his time in the Premier League has been grand. And also kind of you have to play a certain style of play with Lukaku, and that kind of becomes the focal point of the team. So I just think there's more question marks than everybody saying, okay, Chelsea, champions, that's it, let's go.
We'll come back to this in a moment. We've got plenty of reaction as well to the Gerrard conversation. It is 8:39, you're with us here on OTBAM with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. We just want to go to John Duggan quickly. John, how are you getting on?
Good, Owen, Ger and Kenny, yourselves.
Yeah, very well. Good. And another week, another round of virtual insanity. How did we get on last time?
We did well. We'd Scotty Scheffler, the headline tip, 33-1 was fourth. And then the next bet was Abraham Answer at 18-1, and he was tied for seventh. So we made £15 profit on the week. So profit for the year, two tournaments to go, 50%, lads.
Nice one. So you're rolling now, John. What are we looking at for this weekend?
The Houston Open starts tomorrow about 12:40 Irish time. We got Shane Lowry, Graham McDull, Seamus Power in the field. It's a par 70 course. I think the main defence of the course are the greens and the runoff areas around the greens. Feeling very confident, lads, as you would. The whole rationale and explanation for the tips are on the OTB Sports app and on otbsports.com. I was getting out my quill pen, my fountain pen and my ink, and the ink went all over the table last night, constructing and generating the beauty of these tips that are now freshly made for you, everybody, to have a look at responsibly and maybe just inform your opinion if you're getting involved in this, because it is a bit of fun. It's meant to be fun. It's not meant to be anything else more than that. But the headline tip is, I was like, listen to Duran last night, folks, because I'm a big 80s head. Hungry like the wolf. And Matthew Wolf is the main man for me this week. He's what, 33-1 for six each way. Matthew Wolf, one of the most talented players coming out of golf at the moment. It was a college teammate of Victor Hovland who won last week. Matthew Wolf was second two tournaments ago. He shot 61 in Mexico last week. You might remember him second behind Bryson DeChambeau at the US Open last year. He's found his game again. He had a few issues off the course. He's come back into golf, Matthew Wolf, and he's confident about his game. It's his first time looking at this course, but this is a course that suits big hitters. And Matthew Wolf, I think, each way at 33-1 is the headline tip this week. I do like Matthew Wolf because he's so naturally talented. You got to back natural talent in golf, and the 22-year-old has it in bucket loads. The next one is Scotty Scheffler, last week's headline tip at 18-1. This is for five each way. Scotty Scheffler was fourth in Mexico last year. He's from Dallas, so he's only from up the road from Houston. He shot 65 in this tournament. He was gearing up for the Masters because the Masters was the following week last year. He doesn't have that distraction this time. He's desperate for that maiden PGA Tour win. He played so well at the Ryder Cup. Remember, he took apart John Rahm in the singles. Scottie Scheffler is a solid each-way play. The third one is Taylor Gooch, who was playing as well as Colin Cooper, I think, did for Kerry in his heyday, the Gooch. This is Taylor Gooch, the American. So what is his form? His form is 11th last week. Could have been better, but for a double bogey at the last. Tied 4th, tied 11th, tied 5th. And last year in this tournament, he shot a 63 for 4th place. He's got the recent form. He's got the course form. He's 30-1 for each way, Taylor Gooch. 4th selection, Christian Buswedenhout, the South African, is 50-1 for 4 each way. 15th in Mexico, has good short game. A progressive player. He's won 3 times the European Tour. Like the South Africans, they generally don't have issues around bottle. He's 27 years of age now, 5th of the PGA at Wentworth. He's got his US Tour card. Buswedenhout could be a lively outsider at 50-1. And a couple of the stragglers for big prices. Harry Higgs, the freewheeling, lovable Harry Higgs. Reminds me a bit of John Daly. 100-1, 3 each way for Harry Higgs, the people's champion. 4th of the PGA, Kiwa Island. That was an indication of his natural talent. Has made his way through the tours. Was in the top 10 of the CJ Cup recently, Harry Higgs, for 3 each way. I think he could surprise a few people this week. And the best putter on tour in 2019 and 2020 was Denny McCarthy. If he wins, I'm just going to tweet out, Denny, you've got taste. Denny McCarthy is 150-1 for 3 each way. Once again, played well in Mexico last week. Likes Bermuda greens, which he's going to encounter here this week in Houston. So Denny McCarthy, 150s. Harry Higgs, 100s. Buswedenhout, 50-1. We've got Taylor Gooch at 30-1. We have Scottie Scheffler at 18s. And the headline tip is Matthew Wolff at 33-1. The reason why the 6 of them, there's 156 players in the field every week in these PGA Tour events. And it's all about not winning or losing. It's all about making profit at the end of the day, folks.
You like the sound of any of them, Kenny?
I was thinking, John got me thinking about those Duran hits at the very start there. So I was trying to think of another play on Moors. The only one I could think of is the Living Daylights. Jason Day. John, can you give me odds on Jason Day?
Continuing on that Duran team.
That's a ha. Not Duran Duran.
What? You're thinking of A View to a Kill, Kenny.
Oh, no. Let myself down there. 80s pop.
quickly think of a pun on A View to a Kill.
We need a few more quizzes. 80s pop.
We do, actually. We'll bring it in for the next...
Really worked hard on that one as well, John. I really worked hard on that one. Blown it.
John, there's obviously big news in the golf world over the course of the last 24 hours, not just your virtual insanity tips, but the European Tour is technically no more. How big a deal is this? How big a shift is it for those who have been playing on the European Tour, first of all?
Well, first of all, it's the prize fund. It's $2 million per tournament. I think, like, remember a few years ago, we had the whole worry about the Irish Open being actually in existence. Now it's guaranteed. It's Mid-Mount Juliet next year from the end of June into early July ahead of the JB McManus Pro-Am, and then we've got the Open Championship. But what a month that's going to be for golf. Look, this is all about, this is very sad for me. This is like, look, sport, I don't know if sport sold its soul, but sport has got itself involved in this geopolitical struggle that's going on in the Middle East. We see it in football with what Manchester City and Newcastle and the whole issues around Qatar and the Saudi and the rivalry and the whole piracy issue and all that kind of thing. Now you're having it in golf, where Greg Norman has been the public face of the Saudi, development of interest in golf. That the Greg Norman was behind a proposed world tour in the 1990s. That never got off the ground. It's believed that, like, you've got that Saudi international tournament at the start of the year, and Saudi Arabia, once again, seems to want to be getting into sport in some way to, you know, boost its profile. But what happened yesterday was, the European Tour, as a brand name, is no more. It's now going to be called the DP World Tour. DP World is a logistics company based out of Dubai. There's going to be, 47 tournaments across over 20 countries, including new tournaments in the UAE. We've already had European Tour events in Malaysia and Australia. So, like, the European Tour has always had international events before, but this has now been branded as the DP World Tour. There's also 3 tournaments that are co-sanctioned with the PGA Tour. I see a circling of the wagons here. I see a circling of the wagons between the PGA Tour and the European Tour to fend off any challenge from the deep-pocketed Saudis to attract players into a rival tour. That's what I see here. Rory McIlroy is very much behind the DP World Tour. I suppose what the current tours have in their favour is the fact that the players, no matter how much money has been offered to them, and a lot of people are attracted by the money, it's that the majors still hold so much prestige, and they're pretty much come through the tours, the Open Championship, the US Open, the Masters, and the PGA Championship. So I think that will always probably keep the status quo, but they've moved quickly now to try and obviously increase the pot for players. How much money is enough, I suppose, is the question you have to ask, and ring fence the current status quo.
All right, John Duggan, great stuff this morning. Thanks a million.
All right, folks, mind yourselves.
John Duggan there on the line, and you can catch out or catch his tips on otbsports.com.
Just like I was caught out.
Yeah, that was a disappointing moment.
Damn it.
We've all just been trying our best to
let
think
myself
of
down.
Duran golf puns over the last little while, and it doesn't feel like anybody's come to the table with anything better than John's.
How many hits today? But they had about. Through the course of the 80s. Jam must know a few Duran Duran.
Owen doesn't know who Duran Duran are there, Kenny.
Of course I know who Duran Duran are. How dare you?
Who's the lead singer, Owen?
I saw them live. I saw them live once at some festival, I can't remember. That's
slightly inebriated, clearly. Owen, have not very little recollection.
Slightly,
you suggest.
You can't name any of the associated individuals from Duran Duran at all.
It was not Gordon Taylor. It's the PFA. Ian Taylor. No, he's a footballer as well.
No,
isn't he?
We've got
two people here. So I mean, you're the only person in this.
John Taylor.
Simon Le Bon obviously should be
Simon
embarrassed. Should be embarrassed.
He's never heard of. He doesn't. Yeah. Yeah, I just wanted to point that out there.
Thank you, Jer.
Grey hair, Simon Le Bon, grey hair. I
appreciate being patronised by the man sitting in front of the leather-bound books. Thank you, Jer. I really do.
There's no leather-bound books.
It is A48.
The Living Daylights. Hold on. The Living Daylights was not Duran Duran. It was Aha.
That's what John Duggan said.
Jer, can we have this? Have we got an investigative team here at the radio station?
It says on Google.
Yeah, the Living Daylights theme song. It's a theme song to the movie. It's disappointing. Disappointing, certainly, that you get that wrong, Kenny. OTBAM is with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. It is 8:48 a.m. And if you've been following the Irish Women's World Cup qualifiers in any way, or have had even the slightest eye on the Women's Super League, you'll know that there's only one person everyone is talking about. That is, of course, Ireland captain and Arsenal star Katie McCabe. And she was a special guest on this week's Koi Gig pod, and we're not the only ones heaping praise on her, because she's had some pretty big compliments from some serious names in the footballing world as well. Have a listen.
You've been praised by, say, Arsenal legend Ian Wright, also like Irish players like McGrath. What's it like for you to see someone like that? And say, I think Ian Wright, a couple of times it's been names thrown over, and he's like Vivian Miedema, Tobin Heath, all these massive international stars. And he goes, Katie McCabe, that's who is playing, is my current favourite player. Like, how does that feel to you when you hear that?
Yeah, it's really nice. Obviously, for a legend like Ian Wright, he came to our game, I think it was the Everton game in Pearson. I know he's an advocate of women's football over here, and he does fantastic things for the game. So yeah, to be getting comments from Ian, it's pretty special. But yeah, quite humbling. But ultimately, he's a lover of Arsenal, and so am I. So we just want to see the club doing well, you know. And even the tweet from Paul, that was pretty cool, I have to say. Oh, yeah, pretty cool.
I'm pretty sure when Ian went to that game, you could actually like hear him on the broadcast shouting. Like, he was that loud and so happy just to be at a match. It was quite enjoyable.
Like, he's an Irish legend, then obviously him keeping an eye on our games, it just shows how big this is getting, this women's football. We're growing, and yeah, we're not going to stop. We want to keep going and keep getting talent full. Hopefully we'll break some records this month by getting people in. Obviously with COVID, I think all the COVID attendances is, I think that's gone now, so yeah, hopefully we'll break a record this month and yeah, keep it going.
Yeah, that was Ireland captain and Arsenal ace Katie McCabe on this week's episode of the Koi Gig Pod on OTB Sports in association with Cadbury FC, official snack partner to the women's national team. The full episode is available to podcast right now and every Tuesday on the OTB Sports app, and you can watch it back on the Off the Ball YouTube channel. Now at 8:51 on this Wednesday morning, we can welcome Will O'Callaghan to the show. Will, good morning.
Morning, lads. How are you getting on?
Good. We just wanted to chat to you because of this story that's ongoing with regards to the Women's World Cup, Women's Rugby team, I should say. The back page of the Irish Independent, for example, has players blast spineless Eddie Maloney and Murphy lead backlash against IRFU Director of Rugby's comments on World Cup failure. This is, of course, Anthony Eddie, and it does seem that one of the most important voices that we've seen over the last couple of days, because there has been a few, is someone like Cliona Maloney, who is obviously a current player with the Ireland team, coming out, and her tweet was, "I could have sworn slurry spreading season was spring. I stand corrected." That is in relation to Anthony Eddie's comments. There's been a serious backlash this week, Will.
Yeah, it's quite something, isn't it, Owen, that we're here 48 hours away from a game, historic fixture, really, the first time that the RDS will have hosted a senior women's rugby international when Ireland play against the USA on Friday evening, and the back pages are splashed with the fallout from the World Cup qualification bids coming a scupper in Parma, and then Anthony Eddie's comments at his press conference on Monday, where he was talking about the review which is taking place currently into what went wrong, and particularly, I think, malaise about Irish women's rugby, which has followed on from, you know, everything that happened at Donnybrook with the interprovincials just over a month ago as well. And within that press conference, he seemed unaware that the players were designated as non-elite for that fixture too. And there's kind of been a common thread throughout the players' comments that have been made, and it is particularly significant when you've got current players on the week of a fixture hitting out against the head of women's and sevens rugby in this country. And that's that there's a feeling of a lack of urgency from Anthony Eddie about trying to remedy some of the issues that are facing the Irish women's team if they're going to be competitive over the next while. And, you know, Anthony Eddie was very clear, he laid out his position that he feels people are wrong if they think that sevens rugby is being prioritised over 15s in this country. And he was saying that, you know, structures have been put in place since he had taken up his position to try and make Ireland competitive. It is extremely clear that they have now fallen behind significantly with England and France, with their pro and semi-pro system and the amount of contracted players that they have. Wales now saying that they're going to contract up to 20 of their players in the next cycle towards the next World Cup means that Ireland, in theory, unless they start to box above their weight, are going to be struggling to finish in third place in the Six Nations. And it's going to take quite a bit of regrowth to try and get back into a position where they could go to a World Cup and be competitive in 4 years' time. So he was keen to point out, Owen, that, you know, there were nine contracted players who were on the pitch in Parma for that defeat against Scotland, but many of those contracted players have a focus on the sevens game. And it's been, you know, fairly clear, whether Anthony Eddie wants to disagree with people on this or not, that they've been looking at the sevens programme as a way to potentially fund itself because of the money that's available on the sevens circuit. And it's very clear that when it comes to professional contracts, because that money is available, they are tying up players who are well suited to playing in the sevens game. And even those who have, you know, transitioned back across, I can assure you that we're going to be having a conversation around Six Nations time about players who were either gone on the world circuit if it gets back up and running properly, you know, post COVID-19, or whether they're going to be available for the new head coach, Greg McWilliams, to play in the Six Nations. Like, this is something that's not going to go away. In the last couple of weeks, you've had Lucy Mulhall go back and play with the sevens. You've had Bavine Parsons was in France, I think, just last week. She's now back in with the 15 squad for these couple of internationals that are going to be played before the end of the year. But if the sevens team want to be as strong as they possibly can be, players like Emily Murphy-Crow, Bavine Parsons, who've become, you know, key players for the 15s, are probably going to be involved in the tug of war situation, and it'll be intriguing to see what team they actually play for when both sides are trying to get them.
Yeah, like you mentioned the Wales comparison there. Anthony Eddie says that Wales actually deal in a similar scenario to Ireland, where a heap of players who are on those contracts are also going to be involved in the seven scenario. And I think that one thing that really does seem to be irking a lot of the voices who've come out against Anthony Eddie over the last little while is this idea that there seems to be a lack of urgency in everything that's happening. Because obviously with the World Cup qualification disaster recently, a review has been started and is due to come out over the next little while. While in the same period, the head coach has essentially been replaced, or the successor to the head coach has been replaced. And maybe you could make a case that when you look at that, it's like, where is the review actually going to work? And is there actually going to be a review into the head coach? And if they've already appointed a new head coach, then what is the point of the review? And again, you can go back to what David Nusafour has said in the past about professionalism and the need for more folks at grassroots, that Ireland isn't ready to go professional just yet. You can see why people would come out against this and say, where is the urgency? Where are the alarm bells ringing exactly after what happened with regards to the failure to qualify for the next World Cup?
Yeah, and
well,
I think
specifically the question.
Sorry, Ger.
Sorry, just Will, before you get into that, specifically the question about accountability has been raised, and clearly there has been an attempt to say that the failure to qualify for the World Cup rests solely at the door of the players. And yet, who is being held accountable for the consistent failures to deliver on the strategic plans? Ultimately, that should be, and it should lie at the door of the directors of rugby. In the men's case, that's Niels Sephora, and in the women's case, that's Anthony Eddy. So he needs to come out and say, yeah, I have been held accountable, and this is what I'm doing to try and change that. But I think their communication around this has been absolutely desperate. If you think back, is it this month? Is it the end of last month that they were apologising again for the Interpros? And then immediately after this, we have what seems to be a chronic misstep in communication at the very best. I mean, you know, fundamentally, it could be that they've not been successful in doing what they were supposed to do and what they set out to do. So they've got a lot of questions to answer here in terms of how they're treating the women's game and what their ambition for the women's game actually is.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point, lads. The fact that, you know, people will have read Catherine Dane's comments from the weekend, where she was talking about the, you know, pain that was felt by all of the players in not qualifying for the World Cup in New Zealand next year, and that, you know, they have to take on their side of responsibility. Because, you know, whatever about the structures that were in place going into that tournament, and any arguments you might have about their preparation plan and how long they spent in camp, the players did under-deliver in that qualifying tournament. Like, realistically, given where Ireland have been over the last 4 years, they should have been able to win that qualifying tournament and go directly to a World Cup. And if not topping the group, they should have been able to finish up in second place, which would have left them very well placed to qualify, you know, through the Repêchage tournament before the World Cup takes place itself. So the players have to take some responsibility, but there has been a feeling, and this has been very clear from the soundings that have come from those who have spoken up, that it's almost like, you know, the weight of blame has fallen largely down on the players. When you look at the five-year program and how many of the targets were missed, particularly on the women's game over the last 5 years, you know, they had to be viewed as realistic targets when they were put down on paper. I don't think they were, you know, particularly ambitious, this idea that over that cycle they would win one Six Nations title, that they'd be competitively within the top three, that they'd be within the top five in the World Cup, and that the seventh team would be qualifying for World Cups and pushing to try and qualify for the Olympics. They missed out on all those targets pretty spectacularly. So that has to be a reflection on your program more generally, rather than the players and performances that they made in three fixtures.
And who's being held accountable for that is the question the players are asking. And I think it is a massive moment when somebody within a squad puts their head up and says, hang on a second, this is nonsense. Like, that is it. You can't come back from that. And I hope that her teammates rally around her, and I hope that they make a collective statement over the next couple of days to try and drive this to a head. One other just point on this one, and I don't know how much longer we have, but maybe you've got Rory O'Connor's piece in front of you there in the Irish Independent today, but reading it, there's a line in it about Niels Sephora and how the expectation is that his contract is just going to be renewed. I mean, I find this surprising. I find that there should be a debate around that, and there should definitely be a kind of conversation about whether or not he is the man to oversee the future of Irish rugby, because what's he pointing to in terms of his success rate?
Well, exactly. But just to give it the specific line from O'Connor's piece, Niels Sephora is about to get a new deal with the union, and there will be no surprise, he says, to see Eddie follow suit. So this isn't just that they have Niels Sephora, this is a situation where Anthony Eddie could also be given a new contract.
I mean, I don't know.
It's intriguing to see what happens there, lads. Because, like, there's potential there for change if they want to make change, because you would imagine that once Philip Brown's successor comes in, if they really want to discuss the potential for, say, sweeping change, now is the time to look at those two contracts. If they're just going to reappoint them, and particularly reappoint them, say, in a multi-year contract, is there going to be much change in the RFU at all, or is it just the guy at the very top who's going to switch in January?
Yeah.
Good question. We should talk to Keith Wood about this and see what he thinks too. He's coming up in a couple of minutes, I know.
Yeah, we're going to get his take on that a little bit later on. Will O'Callaghan, good stuff.
Cheers, lads.
Cheers, Will O'Callaghan on the line there. Plenty of reaction coming in to what we were chatting about earlier on the football front. Just a little bit of a taster on it. Jim says Cunningham was a great defender back in the day. So compliments coming in for your playing career, Kenny, as the morning unravels. You're staring into
the doesn't resolve anything.
No, it doesn't resolve anything.
Regards to Thierry Henry.
Duran Duran sang the song from James Bond when he was in Mayo, A View to a Kill. Shifty lad nails it. Jared's not having that at all. I mean, why even show up to work if you're not going to just enjoy the
hasn't even shown up to work. That's the point. Have the bus drivers around your neck of the woods gone on strike, like the referees around that's Dublin it. Or something for a few days? You can't get out of your house and into town.
That's
what's going on?
Peter is incredulous. Celtic and Rangers, bigger clubs than Villa. Villa will never be in Europe. If he takes Villa and gets sacked, then he won't get the Liverpool job. I don't think he is good enough and will never be. Alonso/Linders will be the next pool manager. Connor says if Gerrard was to accomplish top seven with Villa, it far outweighs what he does with Rangers. He won't have a chance of getting the Liverpool job based on what he achieves with Rangers. Fair points, Kenny?
Well, that's the chat, isn't it? I suppose that's the debate. And time will tell. No, I wouldn't.
He'd need a Europa League run. He'd need to get to a Europa League quarter final or maybe semi final and have not lost a league title at Rangers. That's the level of success that you need to get to.
I think it's that experience in Europe, Jerry. Even I'm talking about going deep quarter final. Maybe that isn't a little bit irrelevant, even in terms of how successful he is in European competition. The fact that he's actually immersed in it. Up there in Scotland, he's actually developing as a manager and actually experiencing that. I just feel as if that's something which will really hold them back going to Liverpool, where you can say, well, the incumbent manager coming in has had no experience on the European stage in the last 2 to 3 years potentially. If he goes to Aston Villa, I think that'll really hinder him. I think regardless of the success that he has in Europe with Rangers, I think the fact that he's actually immersed in it, he's competing year in, year out, whether he qualifies, no matter how he does, I think that's a tick box in terms of his development as a manager and as a coach, actually operating at that level against some of the better and best teams in Europe.
One last one for you, Kenny, before we go to a break. David's been in touch to say he's got a question for Kenny. How did he instruct midfield and defence when he played with teams that had strikers who did their jobs / scored goals but did not track back?
Talking about Robbie Keane. He is.
No, I think you had to be realistic. I mean, it's a I don't think it's always we haven't got time for this, to be honest with you. I'm building up as if I'm going to talk for about 15 minutes here and I can see your panic attack. We've got about 15 seconds.
Give us a nice short burst there.
I can tell you're getting
seconds.
All edgy. I don't even have to look at the atmosphere in the room change as soon as I started talking. Am I right, Jer?
No, I'm
you
relaxed.
Know, I'm not
I'm
even going to start
I'm,
talking.
No, Kenny.
I'm not even going to start talking. Get Keith Wood on. He's, it was a 9-0-3. He's on in a minute and a half, Keith.
I'll tell you what. After Keith Wood, we'll just chew on that for a while, Kenny. We will get Kenny's barking at strikers masterclass at around 9:20 this morning, so it's something to hang around for. Let's tell you what's coming up on OTB Sports Radio today. From 1 o'clock, OTB Gold is with Catherine Switzer. The Call Geek Pod coming your way at 3 o'clock. Retro panel, rugby bombings from 4 o'clock, and then James McLean is OTB Gold from 6 o'clock. Off the Ball is live on your radio from 7 o'clock tonight.
You rattled him.
OTB Sports are partnering with Science Week to ask what challenges. To be honest with you, I'm still laughing at the deco joke from earlier, Kenny. Like, I mean, there was just a moment where it just keeps coming back into my head. It was a good one. OTB Sports are partnering with Science Week to ask what challenges are most important to us and how science might help. Visit scienceweek.ie to share your ideas and find out about the events taking place throughout Science Week 2021. Right, you'll see a clip of our video on the science of nutrition during this break, featuring Claire star Shane O'Donnell and sports dietitian Aoife Hearn. Keith Wood is up next.
OTB AM.
You're welcome back. It is 9:08 on this Wednesday morning and we are turning our attention back to the All Blacks game this Saturday. Delighted to welcome Keith Wood to the show. Good morning, Keith.
Morning. How are you?
Yeah, very well. So when you look ahead to this weekend, are you expecting to see stylistically a very different type of Ireland, or was Saturday something of a new dawn, I guess, in the lifespan of this team?
I've been thinking about that for the last few days. And I think if I reflect on the game, first and foremost, I thought there seemed to be a philosophical shift. The amount of offloads, the looking for space, the looking for guys to tip on, the running of players from depth, which we haven't seen for a long time, I have to say, that was incredibly encouraging. And so I liked seeing elements of that. And I thought it was a very comprehensive performance. Now, the only backdrop you can put against it, and I know everybody has talked about this, but Japan were abject, and I said last week I didn't quite know how much preparation they had. Well, they didn't have a huge amount by the looks of it, because they they decided to go back and play a style of rugby that they played about 15 years ago, which is just to try and kick the ball and not have it in their hands. They were poor. They only played with about 20 minutes to go in the game with the ball in hand. They kicked it very poorly, and their defensive line was awful, and it gave us a huge amount of space. So I think it's very hard to read a huge amount into the game, apart from the fact that there was a marked change in the philosophy to offload the ball. And for me, that's a great step. I mean, I'm very happy with that step, and you can only play what's in front of you. So whether we're going to see much of that, I hope we see some of it, actually. But I don't think we're going to have any space. I think we will probably kick more ball than we did, and we should. And when you're playing against New Zealand, you just have to do it really, really well. But I'd like to see us try and play with that tempo. But I can't see us getting the ball as freely and as easily and as with as much space as we got at the weekend. So it'll be interesting to see what team is picked, and interesting to see whether that team goes about trying to play with a higher level of pace than we've shown in the past.
What changes would you make then, if any, Keith, when you talk about the interest in the 15?
Well, I don't know. You see, it's very hard, and we always put this down, and you're quite happy to hand it over to the coach and then castigate him when he gets it wrong or if it doesn't work out right for him. But like, I looked at Jemison Gibson Park, and I'm a Conor Murray fan, right? So, and I think Conor hasn't hit the mark that he'd like to have over the last few years, though he still has that capacity. And would he play at a higher tempo if that's the game plan? Because I feel like the game plan has been to kick it into the air, and Conor is actually very good at that. I thought Jemison Gibson Park played excellently on Saturday. He looked full of energy. He was there constantly. The ball was off the ground and in the next carrier's hand, be it a forward or be Johnny Sexton, really, really quickly. He was under no pressure whatsoever, but he played very well. So what do you do in that circumstance? Do you say, well, it could be very different against New Zealand, we'd better go with the tried and trusted with Conor Murray? And I wouldn't. I'd continue with Jemison Gibson Park and say, you've done it last week, now we'd like you to see if you can do it against an incredibly serious outfit with no space, and see, are we still able to move that ball very quickly? Because that's something we need to learn. So that's the way I would look at it. I don't think you can criticise him for the fact that Japan were so poor. So when a guy plays well, my belief is you should try and support them to give them another chance always. And he hasn't been a first starter for Ireland, too much. So this is the chance for him to back it up.
Would you expect there to be more of, you mentioned that you necessarily have to kick a little bit more against New Zealand. Do you specifically expect there to be more box kicking against New Zealand, or how do you see that going?
I think you need to get yourself out of your half. You need to move yourself up to halfway, whatever tricks you can do to do that, whatever plays you have to do that. We understand you're going to kick it. I'm not a big fan of kicking in the opposition 22. Are there, and yes, you want to kick to get the ball back. We're not kicking it away. There's a big difference. I thought we showed at the weekend that there was enough of players running from depth to get over the gain line. If you get over the gain line and you get one guy to support you, it means that ball is safe and can be very quick. If you get over the gain line and nobody to support you, it's going to be a turnover against New Zealand, as almost guaranteed. So they're the risks that you have with it. But look, New Zealand kick plenty of ball, but they kick for position. They kick to not put themselves in a position where they give away a penalty and the opposition 10 is able to bang it over the bar. There's nothing wrong with kicking the ball. It's as a game plan that you slow it down to kick the ball in the air. I mean, look, I believe World Rugby should ban the sort of extended tail of a ruck that somebody else joins it to make it back further so you can box kick it, because that just slows the game down too much. I don't think that fits into the game. So kicking is fine. It's got a place. Mm. But I just thought we saw a change at the weekend. And for that, that was good to see, because that's exciting. And I don't mean just exciting. We want to win. And it's trying to get that balance between entertainment and winning is something that's important.
Wanted to get your take, Keith, on the forwards that we've seen and the skills that they brought to the table on Saturday, because it definitely feels as if there has been so much of a discussion around how talented these forwards are, how good their ball playing skills are, and just this sense that they've been held back a little bit at international level. Is this a kind of a sense that they're now achieving what we all know they can achieve when you see the likes of that front row offloading time and time again?
Yeah, I'm not going to fall into that idea of this high achieving pack just yet. Right. We played against Japan and they gave us space. And for whatever reason, Japan were kind of drifting more than press defense and they weren't going for the big collisions. And our players were given the space under which to do it. So I don't think you can just say everything is brilliant and these are the best ball playing. Though they do show great skills, and actually Porter running off the line off Furlong that's a joy to see. I mean, it's the way I'd like to play. And I thought an awful lot of it was pretty good. So, but you can't do it just from one match. I mean, we're falling into the trap that Ireland fall into consistently, and Ireland fans and media, that we see a performance that was very good against a poor team and we could have made them look poor, and that's fine. But that doesn't turn you into, like, we keep talking about the best. Like, that's just absolutely premature. Let the team grow. I mean, I'm interested in seeing Porter move over to one. I don't know that I would have done it because I love the fact of him coming off the bench after Furlong, because it gives us huge strength at tight end. And I think we need that. But I understand the rationale behind it. But it looks very, very strong. And with Kelleher, who I think has matured from the lines, I think that gave him a huge fillip to be considered next in line on that and being brought out there. I like Sheehan because he's a big raw type. And like what I do when I look at the front row and I look at the two hookers in particular, that's our future. Those two guys are our future, and we need one more. And I said it a few weeks ago, Rob Herring is a great guy to have in the background, but these two guys are the future. But if you need to fall back on someone who is accurate and a good player, you can fall back on Herring. But these two guys are big, abrasive, capable, and we need to see them playing in some big matches because they could be serious knockout stars at 25 years of age in a World Cup.
Is Herring still the safest option at hooker just when it comes to set piece?
I think he is a safe option, but I wouldn't be going for safe.
Yeah.
I don't. I'm saying that there is the skill set to have there, and you get the most out of Herring by making certain he's part and parcel of the squad. He's a decent thrower, Herring, a better thrower than the two guys. They haven't the experience of it. I watched their throw at the weekend. They were throwing well. Some of their timing is a bit off. Some of the arc and the ball is a little bit off, but that's, you know, they're learning at an accelerated rate. Even against Japan, which isn't a particularly tall lineout, the pressure of playing in an international is very different from anything else. It's quite a difficult place to be. So you have to learn that, and you're going to go through days where things don't go well. We shouldn't be expecting perfection in these guys when they start. They're going to have to get to that after a period of time. So I would persevere with both of them.
When you talk about... Sorry, go for it, Chair.
Well, I was going to ask about the team selection, right? The maybe with the exception of Robbie Henshaw and potentially one of the wing spots. If you were to offer the coaching tickets, the starting 15 that started against Japan for a World Cup quarterfinal in the parlance, they would bite your hand off. It seems like, in a way, we've got to where we now understand what our first team is. It just seems it's a bit early in the cycle. We're 2 years out, really, from the game, which will define whether or not Andy Farrell's tenure is a success or a failure. And I don't know, it feels like we've got there too soon, in a way.
Well, I don't think we're there yet, Chair. And I do see the point that you're making. And we do have a consistently We get our timing entirely wrong. We're exactly out of cycle for World Cups and have been consistently. And look, if we are seeing two or three players in each position that are getting enough of game time at European Cup level and at international level that we can trust to play, that puts us in an incredibly strong position. So for me, I think we are looking at technical positions more than any of the rest. So if I look at hooker, I think, yeah, we look decent at hooker. We have three hookers, maybe four hookers in Heffernan, and there's a couple of young guys coming through up in Ulster. At tight head, I think we're fairly well set. I wouldn't like an injury to Furlong, I have to say, but I think we're well set. At loose head, I think we're pretty well set. We could do with another big second row. We have a few guys that are thereabouts. We are absolutely stocked in our back row. We have huge amount of players. We're shy still at 9 and 10. And we're not shy of players. We're shy of players playing at the highest level and performing at the highest level. And that's where I'm at the most nervous still, is at 9 and 10. In 2 years' time, when you look at a World Cup, how is Connor going? What's his game like? Is he still fresh? Has he fully got back his confidence to play to the level that he has played at? How is Johnny? Is Johnny able to do it? He pulled the strings the other day. He was under no pressure the other day, but I have to say, I really felt for him on the game. He was quite emotional with it. I thought he played incredibly well. He just did everything well. You know, he took a hard line for a try to fairly non-existent defence, but he saw it. He picked the line, he went through the tackle, and he scored the try. So again, you can't ask any more of him. But we're lacking game time and confidence in the players behind 9 and 10. And that's the worry for me 2 years out, because do we hold on to a guy who'll be 38? Do we hold on to a guy who'll be, I don't know what age Connor will be, 33 or 34? What about the other guys that are coming through? And I often go back to the World Cup that won in 2003 with England. They had a lot of experienced players over 30, but they were all nailed down, fighting off a lot of opposition coming up behind them. And they were having to perform at their absolute best to go and play and to win. So, and they did. I often describe it, Martin Johnson in the World Cup final played the best game of rugby I've seen by a seconder, and he retired after.
That emotion, Keith, that you mentioned that we saw from Johnny Sexton at the weekend, is that coming from the crowd? Is that playing in front of a full stadium again? Is it for the teammates that he mentioned in his post-match interview about them retiring to empty stadiums? What was the genesis of that? Because it was a different type of Johnny Sexton that we saw.
Well, I think he's under a lot of pressure. Us having a conversation like this is under a lot of pressure. And, you know, everybody thinks that all comments that we make are a personal criticism, which they're not. Actually, we're not in the game of that. Actually, we're trying to do an analysis of something, but we're also in fear for other things that happen. And actually, when we criticise the lack of depth behind Johnny Sexton, that's not a criticism of Johnny Sexton. You know, it's criticism of our structures, that we're not getting the players through to the level that we should be. And it's one of the glitches within our system, that if you have, if you have four out halves playing for the four provinces, you all want them to be knocking on the door of the international jersey. You know, to play for a province is to play for your country, very strangely. That's what it is for the majority, especially in the technical positions, 2, 3, 9 and 10 in particular. You know, they're the guys that you need to be able to do. You can build a team around those players very well, and that's something that we now are beginning to do. We didn't do it with the last World Cup. The last World Cup, we had Rory Best, who was he stayed on too long. I mean, that's the fear. The fear is we're looking at things in the past, and it may not be the same players, but it's different players. But we need players in their absolute pomp, not on coming down the other side of the hill.
That's it. that can be a hard thing to find, Keith.
Of course it is. Yeah. Of course it is. And it's not, so it's not a criticism of the player. Like my criticisms for Johnny at different times is that he has been, our game plan has been entirely based around him, and he has got smashed because he was taking every play was through Johnny, and the opposition teams were targeting left, right and centre. Well, if you looked on Saturday, not every play went through Johnny. So they went through lots of other players. That's a far better opportunity to hold on to that 10 for a period of time.
It is, isn't it? And I actually think that that's the game plan that Mike Catt and Andy Farrell have instigated. And that actually what the game plan that worked very well for Ireland under Joe Schmidt was limited and kind of in one way one-dimensional. And that it asked a lot physically of the players, and that hopefully the injury profile of this team is going to be better than the injury profile of the previous team. But this actually opens up a nice window to the conversation, right? Because in Rory O'Connor's piece about Anthony Eddy, and we can talk about that in a moment, there's a line where he says he expects, and you might have the exact line again there, but he expects that David Nusafora will be renewed or will have his contract renewed. Ultimately, it's not the head coach's job to try and find 4 10s or 6 10s or 6 international quality 9s. Like, what's the point of the director of rugby? Maybe I've misunderstood this whole time what David Nusafora is supposed to be doing, and perhaps he's doing an excellent job, but it's just hard for us outside to see when those problems that you talk about are, they seem to be systemic problems, and the man who's in charge of the system isn't actually being held accountable when the system isn't working.
Well, there's a lot in what you've just said there. Look, the review after the last World Cup was pretty much done by David Nusafora, and he's over it. So that's something that needs to be looked at in terms of governance. That doesn't seem to make a huge amount of sense. It's not a bugbear, but this is an observation I've had for years, is that we have built our professional structure entirely on an amateur base. If you look at it within England, it isn't built on an amateur base. It's built on a professional structure. Now, that's just the nature of it. But we have, like, at some stage, you need to almost have a summit as to what exactly it is you want from rugby. So if you take Munster as an example, and I know that can upset people because I talk about Munster, but I know a bit more about Munster. So you have the schools and you have the clubs, and you then have a professional setup that's on top of it, and a professional setup that tends to run part of some of the amateur elements of it. But if somebody plays rugby, that doesn't mean that they're necessarily wanting to play rugby to play for Munster. They may just want to play Munster. Yeah, or they may just want to play rugby. They just want to play a game of rugby. And to be dictated to by a professional setup is not maybe necessarily correct. We have an issue at the moment. There's an issue with the Munster referees. Huge shortage of referees going in, their games being cancelled. And I know they're trying to sort that out at the present moment in time. But the setup of the game is, patchwork quilt of a structure built on the back of an amateur game from 25 years ago. So I don't know if that's ever been fully addressed. So I didn't complain at all for the fact that the team last week was Leinster and three guys born in New Zealand, because I think Leinster are getting an awful lot of really good young kids through the system and getting them through early enough and giving them enough an opportunity to go and play. And the idea of Ireland being strong is actually the four proud provinces is trying to get players through that system, and by whatever dint of circumstance that didn't work last week, we ended up with the vast majority coming from Leinster. And I'm not saying that that could be a one-off, but we need to be getting our players through all our clubs and schools in the four provinces to try and get to maximise them. Just moving a player from Leinster to Munster, to Connacht, because they have a surplus of players there and we're not generating them, that is not resolving the issue of the provinces, because the province is supported by the province, and the fans would rather the players were coming through their own system. because there's a different type of player in Munster to Connacht to Ulster to Leinster. And actually, we are at our best when we have the blend of all of them.
And am I right in saying that my understanding would be that that would be New Safora's job to fix that, and that by most measures doesn't seem to have delivered on that?
Well, no. Well, I think that is his job. I think, well, his job is to prepare players for, to make certain that there's enough of high performance players for the international team. There's a lot of high performance players coming through the Leinster system. There is a few coming through Munster. That's happened. There is a few coming through Ulster, and a few coming through Connacht. But for me, it's the blend of trying to get all those players coming through at once. And I'm saying there is, I don't know if there's a difference in how each of the provinces do them. But look, I'll go back to the Munster line. A Munster team that won European Cups were mostly from Munster. They had a sprinkling of players from overseas or from elsewhere who all were welcomed with open arms. But you want to have as many people from the province as you can. Otherwise, you begin to lose some of the tradition and some of the support.
For sure. Keith, great stuff this morning. Thanks a million for taking the call.
Cheers, gents.
Thanks a million. Keith Wood there on the line. It is, of course, Ireland against the All Blacks on Saturday. And then, of course, you got the women's team up against the USA on Friday as well. So at 9:31 this morning, we've only got a couple of minutes to wrap up. Kenny, let's go back to your...
I think we should leave it there, actually. I think Keith's raised the bar.
He's raised the bar too high.
I think we should just leave it alone.
We're going to have to get you back in.
See the whole edifice just crumble in the next couple of minutes
We're going to have to get you back in to do your barking orders at strikers slot. We have that penciled in for whenever you're kind enough to come back in. I just did want to get your prediction for tomorrow night before we wrapped up.
Oh, never. Well, you shouldn't have gone down that cul-de-sac. No, I'd never give a prediction before I see a team sheet. If you've worked with me long enough, Owen, you should know that.
Oh, is that right?
Well, yeah.
We usually have you in the morning after a game, then, I guess, reacting to the game rather than teeing it up.
You need to watch up me about 45 minutes before kick-off, really, to bring this to its natural conclusion. We both know I'm not going to take that call, let's be honest.
Are you hopeful then?
Oh, that's a bit of a... Yeah, of course. Yeah, I am hopeful for the reasons that I said earlier. I just think it's going to be a great occasion. I'm looking forward to it. I just hope that we can get the kind of level of performance from the players. That won't be easy. We're playing against a good team, but yeah, I'm certainly hopeful. That's all you want to squeeze out of me. I'm prepared to give you that.
Nice one. Well, that's our killer line right at the end this morning. We're leading with that. Kenny Cunningham, hopeful.
Hopefully Duran will tour later this year.
Kenny, great stuff.
And play those old classics.
Thanks a million, Ger, from Shea Gilroy.
Take on me.
Yeah.
Right, it is 9:32. OTBAM has been with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. Tomorrow morning, we're going to be hearing from Gregor Paul to get a New Zealand take on Saturday's clash and much more besides looking ahead again.
OTB AM with Gillette, proud supporters of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow.